Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Renendez, who has been covering the Boston bombings from the beginning and the dynamics of the Sanarev family since. We will look into the three college classmates of Joker Sanarev who were charged today with hindering the investigation by destroying evidence and making false statements. Then we will assess how much Tom Wheeler, President Obama's nominee to head up the FCC, will be a champion of the public interest or an advocate for corporate control, as his professional background as a lobbyist for the telecommunications industry would suggest. Timothy Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, joins us to discuss the critical issues before the new FCC chairman that will determine the future of the public's free access to the Internet and whether the public interest will be asserted over increasingly dominant corporate influence. Then finally, the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, Winona Horta, joins us for an update on the so-called Monsanto Protection Act that was inserted as a rider in the recently passed continuing resolution to keep the government funded. We'll look into the extraordinary political clout of the food giants that Winona has written about in her new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. And joining us now is the Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez, who has been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has also been covering the dynamics of the Sanarev family. And he received a Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for his coverage of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and in 2007 was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. But today there was an arraignment of a couple of students, fellow classmates of the younger Sanarev, who are from Kazakhstan, and another American citizen, Robel Filipos, was also accused of lying to investigators. What's your sense of the culpability of these three? Are they charged with covering up, or do they have any involvement at all with the actual bombing and the planning of it?
So far, it looks like they had no involvement whatsoever with the actual planning of the bombing or the laying out of the bombs on Boylston Street near the finish line. It looks like all three of them essentially are being charged with trying to cover up Jakar's involvement in the bombing. And it looks like the two fellows from Kazakhstan played a more active role in doing that, whereas the American citizen, Robel, looks like he played a more passive role. His role is not quite as clear as the other two.
But the other two actively destroyed evidence, did they not?
Yeah, the other two actively took some objects from Jakar's dormitory room. There was a backpack that had some explosives in it and some other items, and they also took his laptop. It's not clear exactly why they took the laptop. One of them said that they were trying to make it look natural and not like a theft. So it's not clear that the laptop has any information on it that would shed any light on the bombing. It's really, so far anyway, the backpack that I think is the focus of the investigators, which did have some evidence of the bombing in it.
So, Michael Resendez, did these two from Kazakhstan, the two college classmates of the younger Boston bomber, did they know that he had done the bombing when they did this? Because there was some texting going on between them, was there not? And they did see him after the bombing.
Yeah, according to the federal charging documents, they did know that he was the Marathon bomber, and they did know that there were fatalities and many people injured when they helped their friend take these materials out of his dormitory room and try to essentially destroy them. So they did have some idea of what they were doing. I mean, these are 19-year-old guys. I think their primary motivation was probably to help a friend and a guy that they liked a lot. But they should have been aware of what he was involved in, and the fact that, that as I said, there were these three fatalities and hundreds injured.
But apparently when the FBI released the pictures of the two brothers, before anybody knew their identity, one of these roommates from Kazakhstan texted Jokar Sanayev to say that he resembled the suspect. And Sanayev responded by texting the phrase LOL, which means laughed out loud. You better not text me. Isn't that pretty incriminating?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a little cryptic as well.
Sure.
It's not clear exactly what it means, but as I said, I think that the two fellows from Kazakhstan did know that Zhikar was one of the Marathon bombers and had been involved in something pretty horrific, and yet they went ahead and helped their friend take these materials out of his dorm room and destroy them, which is essentially destroying evidence of a terrible crime.
And they've been held, what, for about a week, have they not, by the INS for some problem with their student visa?
Yeah, apparently they exceeded their legal stay. I think both the student visas had actually expired, and they were being held on those violations the past week. And actually, they had a hearing in immigration court at 7 o'clock this morning. We had a reporter there. So, yes, they've been held on immigration violations, but now, of course, the charges are much, much more serious, and they're also formal.
And again, I'm speaking with the Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez, who's been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has been doing a lot of reporting on the dynamics of the Sanara family after the bombings. And as it happens, Michael, a good friend of mine, I talked to him the other day, he's a former very senior official in the CIA, who used to be the station chief in Kabul, and I called him up to talk to him about the CIA giving bags of money to Karzai, and completely unrelated. And he said, "Oh, I'm having the worst time." He said, "There's crazy conspiracy theorists in the press are onto me because my oldest daughter married the uncle of the Sanara brothers, the very fellow that's come out and denounced his nephews as losers."
Oh, wow.
And, of course, needless to say, the conspiracy theorists are connecting the dots as they do, whether they make any sense whatsoever, that somehow now the CIA's fingerprints are all over this damn thing. So,
boy,
you can't make this stuff up, you know.
It's true. And, you know, part of the reason I think you can't make it up is because although we don't know if there was any outside help that was given to the Tsarnaev brothers, but more and more, this looks like an act of homegrown terrorism and perpetrated by some young people who weren't all that bright. So sometimes as we try to ascribe logic to their motivations and try to figure out why they did what they did, it's quite possible that they just simply weren't being logical at times.
And do you think these three that have been arraigned today fit into that category? They're just not too bright?
It does look that way, yeah. I mean, you know, when you take a look at the Tsarnaev brothers, after their photographs were revealed to the world, it doesn't seem like they had much of a plan at all to get away. They didn't have any money. They only had one gun. They end up killing an MIT police officer, and they failed to get his gun out of the holster, so they killed the guy for nothing. And then they spent a couple of hours driving around Brighton, which is a neighborhood in Boston, and Watertown and Waltham, somewhat aimlessly for a couple of hours before the shootout. So, I do think that these fellows, at some level, appear to just not be too bright.
And Michael Resendez, tell me about what you've discovered about the family dynamics. I mentioned the uncle who very quickly made himself available to the press and had a press conference where he denounced his nephews as losers and how they had blackened the family name and blackened the entire Chechen ethnicity. He, and of course, as I mentioned, just by coincidence, he happened to be married, 20 years ago. They've been subsequently divorced for 20 years to the daughter of a friend of mine. But tell me, though, what have you learned about the actual family? Because obviously the parents are in Chechnya, or actually in Dagestan.
They're in Dagestan, yeah.
Yeah, but there is the wife in Rhode Island, and there are two sisters as well, are there not?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I guess what strikes me is how different the brothers are, in the sense that the younger brother, who arrived in the United States at a much younger age, probably about 8 years old, and went to a grammar school before getting into high school, the younger brother seems to have assimilated much more successfully. He was a very, very popular student at Cambridge Ringen Latin High School. He had lots of friends. He played a lot of pickup basketball and went to a lot of parties. And he was also an honor society student who got a scholarship to go to UMass Dartmouth. And in a lot of ways, he seemed like a kid who had a lot going for him. On the other hand, the older brother seems to be somewhat the opposite. I mean, he came to America as a teenager, probably about 16 years old, more difficult age, and he seems to have been a lot less successful at living in the United States. I mean, for instance, the guy really didn't have a job. I mean, at times he described himself as a driver on his marriage application, and his aunt said that at times he was delivering pizza. But for the most part, this is a guy who had no visible means of support. He attended a community college part-time for 3 semesters, and that was it. He was a fairly accomplished amateur boxer, but he never made any money for it, and it didn't look like he ever would make any money for it. So this is a guy who really was a bit at sea and a bit lost. And meantime, he had gotten married and had a three-year-old daughter, and really had no way to support her, and really had no place in the world for himself that he could see before he latched on to this radical form of Islam. So the brothers, I think, are quite different in striking ways, and it does appear that the younger brother came under the influence of the older brother, somewhat tragically, in the absence of their parents.
But the younger brother, given of what he did and how much he was a sort of good soldier along with his older brother, and he doesn't seem to be, I mean, there are varying reports on the extent to which he's cooperating. Apparently he asked for his Miranda rights and lawyers fairly consistently, and it's difficult to know exactly what's going on there. But I get the impression that the brainwashing, if that's the case, from the older brother, looks like it worked.
Yeah, it does look like it worked. And what is really so striking, and we have a young guy who works in our sports department here at the Globe, who graduated from high school with Jahar, and he just can't believe that Jahar would have done anything like this. And I think that's been the reaction from most people who knew him, because unlike other individuals who've been involved in some of the recent mass shootings, the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, for instance, the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, and Tucson, Arizona, these were all perpetrated by guys who were considered to be strange, oddballs, loners. And Jahar is strikingly different. This is a guy who is very sociable, not a loner at all, very popular, very well-liked. And yet he's also shown us that he had absolutely no conscience whatsoever. I mean, after the bombings, he went back to the UMass Dartmouth campus and just picked up life where he had left off, going to the gym to work out, going to his dorm room. We think he might have went to a party with some soccer players. It's rather incredible.
So what do we know about the parents, though? I mean, you mentioned the absence of the parents allowed the older brother to become a kind of surrogate parent and influence the younger brother. But the parents themselves, the mother was arrested for shoplifting. Apparently, they took tremendous amounts of government programs, up to $100,000+ worth of programs, from that I understand, along with food stamps and other things. So what was their story coming here to the United States?
Well, their story is also, like the older brothers, I think, a bit troubled. I mean, they did get divorced. There was clearly friction between the two of them. And like the older brother, it appears that neither of them ever settled into a good job or a reliable, comfortable routine here in the United States. As you said, the mother was arrested for shoplifting at one time before her own deepening fealty to Islam. She was giving facials in her apartment and that sort of thing. The father worked as a mechanic in a garage for a while and then went out on his own, but not because he was successful enough to buy his own garage. What he did is he got permission from the owner of a rug shop to work in an alley behind the rug shop, just repairing the cars of people who heard about him and would take their cars over to the alleyway. So neither of the parents were very successful, and because of their divorce, one surmises that the household was a little bit unstable, at least when the two brothers were growing up there.
And the sisters, did you get any access to them, or have you talked to them?
I have not talked to either of the sisters, and the other media have interviewed them, I think, very, very briefly. They appear to have been eager to leave, and there isn't much that is known about them. I think one of them have a drug record, but there's very little that's known about them.
I see. And what are the chances of either of the parents showing up here in the United States? I believe that the widow of the older brother did sign off on having the body collected of her late husband.
Yeah, that's correct. But I think it's going to be the uncle you mentioned who's down in Maryland. I think those are the people who are going to take possession of the body. I think the parents' trip, as I understand it, back to the United States has been delayed. I'm not sure what the reason is. I do know that the father, Anzor, has diagnosed with cancer at one time, and he may feel that his health is not good enough for him to travel to the States. But in any event, my understanding is the body will be claimed by the relatives that are now in Maryland.
And the mother may not be coming because Russian intelligence have indicated that they've intercepted phone calls with her and her older son that indicate that she may have helped in his radicalization.
Yeah, there is some indication of that. I'm sure you saw her press conference from Dagestan. I mean, she was clearly distraught and grief-stricken and a bit hysterical. So,
and in denial, too.
And in denial, exactly. So I'm not sure she'd be able to make a trip to the United States either.
Right. Well, since this has happened in your city and you've been covering it, Margaret Resendez again, Boston Globe's investigative reporter, when are we going to put this past us? Because one of the things I find so extraordinary about this is the low price of terrorism but the high cost. In other words, you know, it's like going back to the box cutters that took down all these planes and these buildings. And in this case, a couple of amateurs causing such mayhem and shutting down a major American city for almost a week. That part of it I find extraordinary. We're told that asymmetrical warfare may well be haunting us for decades, but you've experienced it firsthand. What are the lessons, and how's the city coming back?
Well, the city's coming back just fine. I mean, the city has shown a remarkable spirit that is at the same time generous, determined, and tough. Immediately after the bombings, I think as President Obama noted, people were going to Fenway Park without a second thought. There are joggers out all over the city. As someone who ran the Boston Marathon this year and has run it several times in the past, I can assure you that there'll be a Boston Marathon next year and that there'll be many more to come. So I think the city has really come together in a terrific way. But I think the incident also gives all of us great pause because, as you said, it was so easy to commit these acts of terror. The pressure cooker bombs that the Tsarnaev brothers made could be put together for under $100 a piece with commonly available components. The pressure cooker, I mean, these things are routinely used to cook rice or beans, and, you know, they're stuffed with nails and ball bearings and some gunpowder, and voila, you have a powerful bomb. Virtually anyone could put it together. So I think that's got to give all of us, especially law enforcement, great pause because, in a way, I think, as President Obama also said, that this is even tougher to prevent than a well-financed act of international terror.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Resendez.
Sure, my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez. He has been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has also covered the dynamics of the Tsarnaev family. In 2007, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a winner of the Public Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists for the Spotlight Teams. That's the investigative team with the Boston Globe's series on abuses in the debt collection industry. And in addition, he co-authored the book Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church, and was a contributing author to Sins Against the Innocent, Sexual Abuse by Priests, and the Role of the Catholic Church. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into President Obama's choice as the new head of the FCC. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Timothy Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Previously, he served as Executive Director of MediaChannel.org and Vice President of Global Vision New Media. He has also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time, The New York Times, and the Australian Consolidated Press. He blogs at Media Citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Carr.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, thanks. And the president nominated lobbyist turned venture capitalist Tom Wheeler on Wednesday to be the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Wheeler has headed both the National Cable and Telecommunications Association and the Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association. And he is now a venture capitalist with Core Capital. So he's basically been a lobbyist and heading up these two trade groups who are interested in pretty much one side of the issue, are they not? I mean, this is not a public advocate we're talking about here, is it?
Well, he also has one additional qualification that's probably important in the eyes of the Obama administration. He was a top bundler for the Obama campaign. So he has also done some pretty significant favors during the election by raising a lot of money to support Obama's election and re-election. So, yes, there's significant reason from the perspective of a public interest advocate and from the perspective of a consumer advocate to be concerned about the experience that Wheeler brings to the job. Now, there's one other interesting aspect of his tenure, and is that he's also maintained a blog in which he's blogged about telecommunications and media issues rather extensively. So we can pore over some of his writing there and get a sense of where he might stand on some important issues that the agency will face in the coming years, issues like net neutrality, issues like universal access, issues like how we're going to use spectrum so that the new generation of people using wireless smartphones and things like that won't be slowed down or won't have their connections blocked in certain ways. So it's an important time at the Federal Communications Commission, and we are hoping that Wheeler's critics are wrong and that he'll actually be someone who supports the public interest.
So what can we learn from his blogs?
Well, he's written about a lot of issues. He wrote about the AT&T T-Mobile merger. People might remember a couple of years ago that AT&T tried to gobble up T-Mobile and create one of the largest wireless carriers going. And that merger was ultimately blocked when the Department of Justice said that it would sue on trust grounds, antitrust grounds. And And he wrote about that, saying that it might have been better to allow the merger to go through because it would have allowed the Federal Communications Commission to regulate a merger. There's a debate going on between whether you would rather have a regulated monopoly like the old Ma Bell or whether you want to have an unregulated, a competitive marketplace. And he was arguing that he would have preferred approval of that merger, creating this massive carrier so that the FCC would then have the opportunity to regulate in the public interest. So it was a somewhat nuanced position. Free Press, of course, and a lot of the public interest groups opposed the merger full stop, and he had a little bit more nuanced position there.
Well, he obviously wasn't a customer of AT&T because they have the most appalling service. And they spend so much of their money on advertising and lobbying, but they don't invest in cell towers, et cetera.
There was another fallout potentially from that merger as well, which was the loss of potentially tens of thousands of jobs. You know, mergers of that scale they end in massive layoffs. In the industry, they like to term these things rationalizations or. But what ultimately mergers of that scale mean is that you'll see a lot of layoffs across the industry. So that it was pretty vehemently opposed on those grounds as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Timothy Carr, who is the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, previously served as Executive Director of MediaChannel.org and Vice President of Global Vision New Media. He's also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time, The New York Times, and the Australian Consolidated Press. And he blogs at Media Citizen. And we're talking about President Obama's appointment on Wednesday of a new head of the FCC to be the chairman, Thomas Wheeler, a lobbyist and a representative for two big industry trade groups that are very much interested in the FCC and have a lot of issues before the FCC. And we're discussing the lack of or the fact that an advocate for the public was not chosen, given that we always hear that the public owns the airwaves and we lease these airwaves out to the likes of Rupert Murdoch. And here in Los Angeles, of course, we're very concerned that the FCC would allow the Koch brothers, for example, to buy the Los Angeles Times. So there's no question that the deck is stacked against the public. And you mentioned the issue of net neutrality. That comes up at the end of the year. The court is going to rule on that. And unfortunately, it's the D.C. Court of Appeals that isn't dominated by Republicans and always rules against the White House, as they did recently on stymieing the recess appointments that the president has been forced to make because of the Republican filibuster in the Senate. Now, the Janikowski rules could well be struck down, could they not? I mean,
yes, absolutely, and you're absolutely right that that federal appeals court has not been particularly good on a lot of issues, and this is and they're going to be deciding on one of the central questions for the FCC, the question of whether or not the Federal Communications Commission has the authority to protect consumers, in particular, to protect consumers' ability to speak freely and choose freely via the internet. There are two sides of this argument going right now in Verizon, which has filed suit against the FCC open internet order, is claiming that the First Amendment gives it the right to censor the internet. It's a sort of Orwellian a twist of ideas that you could only imagine a corporate attorney for a communications company making up. But their basic argument is that Verizon and other internet service providers have the First Amendment right to censor internet users. And what we have argued at Free Press and others is that the FCC has the authority through the Telecommunications Act to protect internet users' right to choose what websites they want to go to, what services they want to use, whom they want to share information with, without the ISP interfering and saying, well, wouldn't you rather use, you know, our video streaming service, or wouldn't you rather use our VoIP service rather than other services that might be available on the marketplace? So the central question before the court is one of the FCC's authority, and you're absolutely right, given the track record, we expect that by the end of the year, it could be very likely that we won't get a good decision from the court. The court will reject the open internet order that the FCC passed under Chairman Janikowski, and either remand it to the FCC for a decision. It may go to Congress to do something. It may go up to the Supreme Court for an appeal. We don't really know what's going to happen, but we're getting ready to organize people to make sure that ultimately whatever decision is made in Washington puts the rights of internet users before those of internet service providers.
So that argument on that Verizon is putting forth in this suit, and the chances are that the Court of Appeals will rule in Verizon's favor, it's similar to the argument that Citizens United is based on. The First Amendment, corporate free speech means that you can spend unlimited amounts of money in campaigns, and corporate free speech in this case means that you, as the owner of the pipeline, can decide what goes through your pipeline.
Yeah, and interestingly, yes, that's true. And interestingly, there's another Supreme Court decision called Brand X that happened in 2005 that basically said that the FCC does have the authority to determine what power it has over the Internet. And under the Telecommunications Act, which was passed in 1996, it gave the FCC the authority to decide how it classifies broadband Internet services. And that decision of how it classifies it determines its own authority. So interestingly, and I don't want to get too lost in the legal wonkery here, but interestingly, the FCC has also said that the FCC, if this court rejects the FCC's authority under the current order, the FCC has the authority to reassert its authority in a way that would allow it to protect Internet freedom. And it's something that's called reclassification of its authority. So there'll be a big debate with this new chairman, to whether or not he's going to take that action, because that would be a very bold action for the FCC to reassert its authority under what's called Title II of the Communications Act, because the very powerful phone and cable lobby look at that option as the nuclear option. And if he were to move in that direction, you would see the full force of AT&T, the full force of Comcast and Verizon come down on the FCC. So it could be a very interesting time in the wake of that court ruling in Washington.
But these companies that you just mentioned, they are the oligopolies that essentially already control the pipelines. They provide some of the worst service in the developed world for 4 or 5 times the price that you pay in other countries like France and other European countries, who have about 10, 20, 100 times faster broadband service for a quarter of the price. So these monopolies are so clearly putting themselves in a situation where they don't have to provide good services, but they can extract as much money as they like out of consumers. And, you know, the American people simply don't know what a bad deal they're getting. And then occasionally you get a glimpse of how the rest of the world operates, like in Chattanooga, where broadband was made universal as a utility, as a public utility in the Chattanooga municipality. Now, what's happening is that these Verizons and AT&Ts are now proactively suing in state and local governments to prevent them from providing this alternative service to the lousy service that they provide. So let's not have any illusions about what these big oligopolies want.
Well, I mean, the ultimate irony is that they, whenever you talk about the Internet, they like to use this sort of free market argument and say, you know, well, we don't need regulations. We have the free market. Let the invisible hand of the free market determine who wins and who loses in the Internet service. In the Internet service business, but on the other hand, if you actually look at what they're doing, is they're aggressively legislating away competition. You mentioned on the state level, there have been a number of these what are called anti-municipal broadband state laws. There was one in North Carolina. We just defeated one recently in Georgia, but they go state by state, and they try to legislate away competition. They try to take away local communities' ability to build their own broadband options so that they can maintain their local monopolies. And so that the reason that the United States is now falling behind most other developed countries in our ability to provide affordable broadband is because we've allowed these very powerful companies to create a marketplace that has absolutely no competition. And as anyone knows, when you don't have competition and you don't have consumer choice, prices go up and services go down.
And the citizens of Chattanooga have the fastest broadband in the country. I mean, it's really a complete disgrace. Timothy Carr, again, the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. When you say that the new nominee that President Obama has put forth, Tom Wheeler, a lobbyist for the telecommunications industry and a venture capitalist who bundled a lot of money for Obama's re-elections, well, originally elections in 2008 and more recently, when you said that he has the nuclear option, maybe it could bounce back to him and then they could assert themselves. Well, so far, the FCC has not asserted itself. It has a provision in its own charter to assert its influence over the loophole in Citizens United that allows for these corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money, or billionaires like the Koch brothers to spend unlimited amounts of money on television advertising in political campaigns. Now, and we all know that that is where most of the campaign money goes, is in political advertising, and that's the way our campaigns are conducted, via television advertising. So the FCC has the ability to basically force the people who are putting these ads on the air to identify who they are.
Yeah, yes, the FCC, through broadcast disclosure rules, we can't reverse Citizens United through the FCC, but what we can do is force transparency on the system. As you noted, last year, more than $1 billion filtered into, up to $3 billion filtered to local television stations for political ad buys. And a lot of the groups that were making these purchases were these suspiciously sounding organizations like Americans for Prosperity, and they had these names that covered up the true sources of money behind them. And through broadcast disclosure rules that exist now at the FCC, we can force these advertisers, these political action committees, and these C4 independent political groups to disclose who their top funders are. And what we found in the past is that when you actually disclose the funders, you disclose the names of people behind a lot of these ads, the ads themselves are improved. A lot of people don't like their names associated with ads that spread falsehoods or that attack individuals. And so by forcing transparency on the system, you allow people in those markets where they're being inundated with these ads to at the very least know who that message is coming from. And if they hear a message that says, we're for clean coal, and it comes from Exxon or it comes from the Coke Industries, they know that message is suspicious.
But the point is, they could exercise this option, but they don't, the FCC.
They haven't exercised the option. We did have a victory in 2012 where we actually got, we forced the broadcasters to put their political files, which list the names of the groups online, so you can go to an online database and find the names of the groups themselves. But we haven't gone that extra step, which is to disclose the names of the financial interests, the individuals, the corporations that fund these groups. There's still a wall there that we need to break through.
Again, Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. What do you make then of who, well, we don't know who the White House is going to put forth to replace the Republican Commissioner Robert McDowell, who's stepping down, and that's the way these commissions operate. They have Republicans and Democrats, but the president gets to choose a Republican, and if he's a Democrat, he probably tries to choose somebody that's not a Tea Party type. And conversely, if he's a Republican, like George W. Bush, he chooses incredibly right-wing Democrats, as he did with the CTFC, which is another commission that oversees the commodities markets on Wall Street.
Yes.
So at the moment, Obama's designated the Democratic Commissioner, Mignon Clyburn, to be the acting chair. So give us a sense of who Mignon Clyburn is.
Mignon Clyburn is the daughter of a very prominent South Carolina congressman who came up through South Carolina politics. She was working for the State Utilities Commission in South Carolina, which is a very powerful agency, and she has been at the FCC now for, I believe, about 4 or 5 years. And she's proven herself to be a very, very diligent watchdog for the interests of communities of color. There have been a lot of issues around the ownership of radio and television stations and the lack of diversity there that she has shown concern about. So we're fairly confident that during her tenure, and no one knows really how long this will be, that she will be an effective watchdog for the public interest.
Well, of course, her tenure will depend upon how long it takes to confirm Tom Wheeler. Just in closing, Timothy Carr, I recently interviewed Michael Copps, and I did a forum with him the other day out here at Occidental College. He is really an impressive guy, and he has been the champion for the public on the FCC. And he took the lone vote against the Comcast Universal merger that, instead of making it, as they promised, they'd make it better for the consumer, they turned around and just bought more assets and consolidate even further. So he obviously is one of the good guys, and he's no longer there. So how much of a loss is the fact that Michael Copps has left?
Oh, it's a huge loss. He is a rare exception among FCC commissioners on either side of the aisle in that he really did look out for the public interest. He was very outspoken on the issue of ownership. It was during the tenure of Michael Powell, the FCC chair in the early aughts, who was very aggressive in trying to remove a lot of the rules that prevented media consolidation. And Michael Copps really was outspoken. He went to a lot of town hall meetings. He was a real champion of the public interest on issues of ownership. He's also been very good on internet freedom issues. And so he's now in the public sector. He's now actually in the working for civil society, I should say. He's at Common Cause. He's also on the board of Free Press, my organization, and has been a real, you know, outspoken champion. So he'll continue to be active, although it was great always to be able to count on his vote at the FCC.
And, of course, while he was standing up for the public under Bush's appointee, Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell, Michael Powell is flying around in Warner Brothers' jet. I mean, the extent to which these guys are compromised by the power of industry is breathtaking. And it's such a rare exception that you have somebody that stands up for the public.
Well, I looked at the 26 commissioners who have served the FCC since 1980, and more than 20 of them, 21, actually left the FCC to work for companies that they were meant to regulate. So if there's ever an agency that suffers from industry capture, it's the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Timothy Carr.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Timothy Carr, who is a senior director of strategy for Free Press. Previously, he served as executive director of MediaChannel.org and vice president of Global Vision New Media. He's also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time, the New York Times, and the Australian Consolidated Press. He blogs at Media Citizen. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the executive director of Food and Water Watch.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Attack of the killer tomatoes. Attack of the killer tomatoes. They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch. They're marching down the halls. They're crawling up the walls.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Winona Horta, who is the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, a D.C.-based watchdog organization focused on corporate and government accountability relating to food, water, and common resources. She has worked and written extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues, and owns a working farm in Virginia. Her new book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Winona Horta.
I'm so glad to be here.
And Winona, we know that, of course, recently there was passed by the Senate, by the House, the so-called Monsanto Protection Act that was inserted as a rider into the continuing resolution to keep the government funded. And that shows you the extraordinary power of these big agribusiness companies. But today, Senator Barbara Boxer and Representative Peter DeFazio introduced a new bill that would require the labeling of GMOs, the Genetically Engineered Food Right to Know Act, which has 20 sponsors. And this, of course, after the Proposition 37 was defeated here in the state by massive infusions of money from the Monsantos, et cetera. What's your sense of one? I guess the good news is that the continuing resolution ends in, 5 months' time. So being Monsanto's immunity from any lawsuits will be over then, right?
Well, that's right. Now, the problem is that the way the dysfunctional Congress has been operating, these budget bills don't end when they're supposed to, which in this case would be the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. They tend to have a longer life. And, this inclusion of the rider in the budget bill, I think, does really demonstrate the power of Monsanto and the biotech industry. You know, we took a look at how much they had spent on campaign contributions and lobbying over a 10-year period. This is Monsanto and the other biotech companies. They spent $572 million. They hired 13 former members of Congress, 300 former staffers for Congress and for the White House, and they have about 100 lobby shops in Washington. So I don't think that there's any accident that when they want something, they can waltz into congressional offices and write this kind of outrageous rider.
And, of course, if Monsanto has that kind of clout, presumably Cargill, Tyson, Kraft, and ConAgra also do.
Well, that's really what I found in writing my book, Foodopoly, is that we have a handful of food companies that have so much political and economic power that they basically dictate all of the policies regarding food and farming. And this power and consolidation really has its roots in the Reagan administration, where our protective antitrust laws were eviscerated. And since that time, we've seen food companies, and for that matter, every other type of industry, be able to concentrate and consolidate in the hands of just a few companies for each industry.
And Winona Horta, my understanding is that it's not just these powerful agribusiness corporate monopolies that are basically corporatizing our food. But what is also happening is that there's a commodification going on of food itself through the commodities trading on Wall Street, where you have this anomaly that you I think it was 2008, we had a record global harvest of wheat, yet the price of wheat went up, and in many ways the fact that a lot of countries couldn't afford the prices led to the riots that led to the Arab Spring. So, you know, you have it just shows you how much money is being extracted for no good use except to make Wall Street speculators rich at the expense of people trying to put food on the table.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. Food is no longer something that nourishes. Food is looked at as money. And the deregulation that took place in the 1980s and in the 1990s that has allowed this kind of speculative behavior is, you know, it's really outrageous, and it is leading people to starve. And it is responsible in that period that you spoke of 2007-2008, to 200 million people being hungry, even though there were plenty of grains, they just were being speculated upon. And the U.S. is the leader, is looked to as the price setter for grains in the world. And so when there's speculation here, it leads to high prices everywhere.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Winona Horta, who is the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and she has worked and written extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues, and owns a working farm. Her new book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming. We did some coverage yesterday, Winona, on the European Commission banning a group of pesticides, neonicotinoids. Also, we did some coverage on a study at MIT on Monsanto's Roundup is perhaps contributing to cancers and Parkinson's disease in human beings. Today, we learn that Turkey is now banning the importation of 26 genetically modified organisms. So there seems to be some pushback happening around the world, although, as I mentioned earlier, here in the state of California, the proposition to force the labeling of genetically engineered foods was pushed, was defeated, even though today Senator Boxer and Representative DeFazio introduced a bill into the House and Senate.
Well, you know, I think that the biotech industry with Monsanto in the lead and the food processors, the money that they spent in California is actually backfiring on them. People were watching from around the U.S. to see what would happen with the GE labeling initiative. And when it failed, there is so much anger around the country that there are now campaigns in more than 30 states to label genetically engineered food. It's one of the most exciting grassroots movements that I've seen in many years. And there's been legislation introduced in places like Iowa, Michigan, Connecticut, New Mexico. Now, I don't expect that these bills will pass the first time around, but the fact that people are actually working to get legislation introduced means that eventually it will happen in a couple of states. Maybe in Washington state there's an initiative that actually has a pretty good chance of passing this fall. And that will prompt federal action. And so it's exciting to see activists across the country organizing, because when the feds step in, we will need to organize to make sure that we actually get meaningful labeling for genetically engineered food. And I think what's happened is people are just fed up, especially now that we are seeing more than the ingredients to junk food genetically engineered. We saw sweet corn this last year, and we're very concerned about the legalization of genetically engineered salmon. The FDA has just received almost 2 million comments from people saying don't do it, but we're concerned that the biotech industry has a lot of power with the FDA.
Well, I also did some coverage recently, Winona, on how Monsanto has been suppressing research into the effects of feeding GMO organisms like wheat and soy to rats who develop tumors, etc. And they're very proactive in this. So there is a good reason, I think, for the public to be skeptical about these foods, simply because not enough research is being done into them, and Monsanto is preventing a lot of the research. So what is motivating this kind of juggernaut to force this stuff on us without us really knowing exactly what the long-term consequences will be? How do they rationalize it?
I think that when you look at the type of company that Monsanto is and actually look at its history, I mean, Monsanto is a company that made PCBs, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. We still have PCBs in our tissues. And they were also responsible for manufacturing components of Agent Orange, another very dangerous chemical. They've been involved in hundreds and hundreds of different lawsuits. And so they tried to recreate themselves as what they call a life sciences company. I think we might call it a Death Sciences Company, and they are using their economic and political power to try to force this literally down the throats of people around the world. And I think that the fight back that we're seeing is coming at a really good time before we get a lot more foods entered into our diet that are genetically engineered, because there are all sorts of plants that they want to genetically engineer that are in the pipeline. And so it's really important that we stop this, because as you mentioned, there is no long-term research on the effects of eating these foods. And, you know, I think when you look at the amount of power that a handful of companies have over seeds, and seeds are, of course, rice, that this is not something that we can support, this kind of consolidation where a few companies really control and are raising the price of seeds and completely changing the genetics that life is dependent on.
Well, just in the last minute, Wadona Harder, since you're an organic farmer and clearly the family farm, as your book indicates, is a myth. It's now corporate agribusiness dominates. We need to, as you point out in your book, a complete structural shift with a new grassroots movement. And I guess that's the way. That's the best way to fight back, isn't it? For everybody to simply boycott corporate food. And can grow their own.
It is. We need to fight back. We need to not shop and buy these items, but we also need a political fight back. And so I encourage everyone to go to our website, foodandwaterwatch.org. We have many ways that people can get involved politically. And I really wrote Foodopoly as a call to action. We need to vote with our fork. We need to vote with our vote. And then we need to hold these people accountable, because the U.S. has such an impact not only on people in this country, but people around the world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Wadona Harder, again, the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. She has worked and written extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues, and owns a working farm in Virginia. Her new book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.